Hello, and thank you for downloading Wax Lyrical, the advertising and marketing podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. And I'm Mark Renicus.
Hi, and I'm Paul Jacobs. And in this episode, we're talking energy, as our special guest is Clem Hobson, head of brand at Bulb. And we'll be asking Clem to reveal the secrets of Bulb's phenomenal success, why Bulb has members and not customers, when in-housing works, and when you really do need agency support, plus great mentors and favourite TV ads. Hello and welcome, Clem. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. Okay, well, let's dive straight in. And I hope you don't mind me saying you've achieved considerable success in quite early in your career. For example, you're included in Drum's 50 Under 30 last year. So huge congratulations for that.
Oh, thank you.
Take us on a quick journey, if you can, from getting a first in theology at Oxford, specialising in Islam, to then be the head of brand at Bulb.
Yeah, that's right. I did do theology, so I'm a theologian by trade. As lots of people with a theology degree will tell you, you come out the other end of university and you go, what now? And you sort of briefly consider gunning for being a bishop. But you have to be faithful for that. So that was problematic for me. So, you know, I had to look for something else to do. And I thought I'd try my hand at getting inside a business and giving it a go. My dad sort of has a sort of entrepreneurial spirit, and I thought maybe I'll succeed at that. So I, you know, went to work for One Fine Stay, which is Britain's sort of version of Airbnb at the luxury end of the market. And it was quite, you know, relatively small team at the time, and we were growing a lot, and I really enjoyed it. I liked the pace and all of those classic startup-y things of having an impact in what you do, owning things, sort of learning everything by hook or by crook. And I had a great time there. That answered that question of, can I do this sort of work and do I enjoy it? And so from there, you know, I did a few other things. And in the end, I was looking for something. I was looking to join a B Corp, really. B Corp being a community of businesses in the UK who are looking to use business as a force for good. And I guess that's maybe a link with theology, because theology is really all about thinking about how to live a good life. And I was interested in businesses who were trying to have a positive impact on the world. So off I went to join Bulb. It was a small team at the time, about 25, 30 people. We had about 15,000 members in the UK. The rest is history. Been there the last 3.5-4 years. We've grown a lot in that time.
Yeah, it's been a phenomenal success, which we'll definitely come a bit more onto shortly. So, I mean, talking of your education, again, it's a very interesting kind of education into career. So has theology and your background in theology helped, I suppose, your moral compass in business and how you kind of operate day to day?
Yeah, good question. I mean, what I'd really say about theology is it's great brain training. As a subject, you're looking at history and philosophy, and you do a language. So for me, it was really about learning how to get to grips with lots of stuff quickly, and that's, you know, eternally useful. I don't employ my sort of those, you know, theological theories in what I do now, but definitely like my approach to learning and thinking and understanding things. And yeah, I guess that the link is about how to have a good life, and I am still interested in that and tend to be interested in businesses that I think are an answer to that. So, you know, Bulb, obviously I'm interested in Bulb, but when I look around other businesses I'm interested in, let's take something like Farewell, who are trying to kind of, you know, reinvent the end of life experience. Mm-hmm. Those sorts of things are particularly interesting to me, which I think, yeah, tie those things up a little bit.
And thinking back to earlier in your career, if you could have chosen any mentor, and forgive me, it's a bit like a dinner party question, you know, they could be alive or dead. If you could have chosen any mentor, Clem, who would they have been and why?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think my answer is someone fictional. So sorry for not playing by the rules.
No, I love this. I think a fictional mentor. We've not had a fictional one before. I'm fascinated. Go on.
I would choose Dorothea Brooke, who is the heroine of George Eliot's Middlemarch. Don't know if you've read it. It's a hefty old tome, so you'll be forgiven if you haven't. Dorothea for me is someone who's really self-determined, who is wants to make up her own mind about people and things. But she's also someone that really focused her energy on her own patch of the world, you know, her family, her friends, the town she lived in. And I think I agree with the author on this, that that's something that's really to be honoured. And so for me, she's like a little voice in my head. But it's not, I mean, not so much career related, more life related, and, you know, how to behave, really. But yeah, that's who I'd choose. I'd also love to have her at a dinner party.
Me too. Sounds fascinating. Your gathering, that we love to learn a bit about what lies behind our guests. And so another similar question for you. And I have to thank one of my friends for this question. I was asked it on a podcast, and I actually got very emotional when I was asked it. Thinking back to your teenage years, what advice would you have given to your 13-year-old self?
When I think back to me at 13, gosh, so many worries, all about worrying about all the wrong things. So I think my main message would be just let it go and it'll all be fine and it'll work out in the end. I think the other thing I'd say to myself at that age is really the secret to being good at things at life is just simply turning up, at least at the beginning. And
very Woody Allen. That's one of his sayings. That one, just turn up. I think is, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know that, and you know, well, I agree with him on that, if not on other things.
I
think it's sometimes we get a bit daunted by you know, I'm not very good at that, or I don't know how to do that, or you know, am I really good enough? And actually, I think yeah, as I've got older, I realize if you just keep turning up, you keep getting better. And in the end, that's how you get good at things. And I think I tell myself that at 13.
Good advice. I like that.
That's always my favourite question. I like we've shifted the age around. I think it's a good evolution of a great question. So, okay, well, let's dive a bit more into you and Bulb, Clem. So you've been there for almost from the beginning, really. And with most startups, they say they want to disrupt their category. But from what we can understand, Bulb wanted to go that bit further and literally build a business to sort of lead the future of energy. So tell us a bit more about Bulb's vision, that energy future, and kind of what's still to come.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we are a disruptor, I guess. But yeah, also with that longer term, you know, view. So at the beginning, really, it was about building a great new option for people buying and using energy in the UK, and that was an affordable but renewable option. And at the time, that didn't really exist. You know, you could get be supplied by a green supplier, but you usually had to pay quite a bit more than you would elsewhere. So at the beginning, it really was about being greener and cheaper and putting that into the hands of people in the UK. But we were also aware that the world of energy is changing. You know, our co-founders often talk about almost this sort of new industrial revolution we're in now, where the relationship you have with what's currently your energy supplier is going to change a lot. At the minute, you just sit in your house, you know, popping your kettle on, using energy, and then occasionally you sort of pay a bill. And it's a very sort of one-way sort of street from generators straight into your home. But in the future, that's going to change and become a lot more dynamic. So you might have solar panels on the roof or a battery, you know, saving energy in your home. You might have an electric vehicle. So obviously your consumption is going to go up, but you're also going to need to talk to your energy supplier a lot more. You might be thinking a lot more about when you're going to be charging your electric vehicle and not just plugging it in at any old time of day. So knowing that that's coming down the road and that's going to have to change, you know, we saw there's a sort of new role opening up for an energy supplier, which is really more of being an energy manager and helping someone to make sense of that complicated energy world that's going to become a reality for lots of people. And we wanted to sort of build the company that could be that companion to people and could make it all simple and easy and help people to make the greener, smarter decisions about how they're using energy at home. So that's what we're on a mission to do. And, you know, we've made the first steps, but there's a long way to go.
Well, as we've touched on, it's been a phenomenal success story in quite a short amount of time. I mean, for example, when we were chatting before, you mentioned that kind of customer numbers doubled from 1 month to the net, which is incredible. So I assume that's obviously slowed down slightly as you've scaled, but I guess give us some insight, Clem, into kind of the key reasons behind that incredible success.
Yeah. I mean, it hasn't always been like that. I mean, in Bob's kind of first couple of years, it took us 2 years to get to 10,000 members or something. But, you know, then in weeks since then, we've signed up, you know, 20,000-30,000 members in a week. So, yes, it has been a wild ride. We could put it like that. I mean, the first thing to say is that there's a lot of luck and being the right people in the right place at the right time. And that has definitely played its part in Bob's story. You know, we used to say at the time people were really ready for an energy company they could feel good about. And I think the story of Bulb is partly about that. But we also made some good decisions, I think, on the way. And we thought a bit about, you know, where is the market? What do people really want and need from an energy company? What are they missing from that at the minute? And we really focused on being good in those areas. So, you know, whether that was bringing this green offering, which hadn't really been there before at a reasonable cost, or whether that was really focusing on being great at member service and giving people a really good experience when they switched to us or had a problem and had to talk to us. And so, yeah, I guess to use that word again, companion, sort of living up to that was, you know, a big bit in our success. And then, yeah, from Bulb's sort of mindset point of view, you know, I think we have a pretty good culture of, you know, testing first and trying to learn, learn about the methods we have available to grow and really only focusing our energy on scaling the ones that worked. Mm-hmm. So that meant that in the early years, even when we were a small team, we were really focused on the big levers that could, you know, help us to grow. And whether that was our referral program or something, you know, whatever it was, it meant that our energy was taken on the things that really helped us to get to where we are today. But yeah, the final thing I'd say on that is, you know, obviously I'm a marketer. I'm, you know, really interested in that. I think it's really important. It helps, you know, definitely helps businesses to grow. But really, it's a bit like, you know, beauty comes from within. It's about starting with a great product or a great service. And if you have that, the marketing comes easy. And it also feels truthful to people when they experience your product or service as well. So, you know, at Bulb, we were lucky as marketers that everyone else in the teams, you know, on the front line delivering service or building the products that we had were doing such a great job because they helped to make ours easier.
I'm going to make one observation. Please disagree if you want, but I think part of your success is down to the fact that you managed to create a distinctive brand. How did you do that?
A good question. Yes, we do. You know, right from the beginning, Bulb paid a lot of attention to, you know, how we look and feel, and I don't know, in sort of advertising terms, how we show up in the world. And that was, you know, really important to us. And it was with that long-term vision in mind, because we knew that we were going to have to shift the relationship someone holds with an energy company, sort of how it was 5 years ago, roughly how it, you know, still is for lots of people today, to becoming a much more involved two-way relationship. We knew that that would rely on trust. And we knew that we had to be different in order to achieve someone wanting to have that sort of relationship with us. So right from the beginning, we paid a lot of attention to that. And whether that was, you know, in choosing some of the very early decisions, which actually even predate my time at Bulb, like Bulb Pink, you know, it was all about signaling difference. And if you look at, you know, studies, and even I've been in user research myself at Bulb, where, you know, the pink to some people is just, you know, doesn't scream trustworthy in the same way that navy blue does. And some of those decisions were, you know, I think brave, but have been, you know, really essential in helping us to be different. And then, you know, we've carried on in that tradition, always trying to, you know, not behave like everyone else in the category, be brave where we, you know, where we can be. So I think that, yeah, that's where it comes from, really. But over the years, that's come out in lots of, you know, lots of different ways, whether it's the role that illustration plays in how we communicate and the way in which we have chosen and to do TV advertising. So, but it comes from that knowing what we need to do and thinking about how, you know, how to do that well from a communication point of view.
And I've got another observation, if I may. I listen intently to people, and there's something about your vocabulary. And I'll give you an example. So I listened to Dave Lewis, the outgoing CEO of Tesco, and he's got an interesting vocabulary. He prefers to not use the word marketing, and instead he uses the word customer. And interestingly, there's a beautiful segue, because you don't use the word customer. You use the word member, which we mentioned before. So let's let's talk a little bit about that. How do you always ensure that they know the difference between a member and a customer?
Yeah, so that's right. We use members, not customers. And that's been, you know, with us since Bulb, you know, really the start of Bulb. And the reason for that is because we wanted, again, to show to people who were, you know, switching to us that we intended to have a different sort of relationship with them, and one in which we invited them to build our company with us. And that's about, you know, offering them the chance to feedback on things, to help inform the product roadmap we have, to involve them in the business that we're building. And, you know, that's what we set out to do. I think it would be, you know, it's as we've scaled, you know, we've grown from a business with no members in 2015 to 1.7 million today. So in 5 years, it's really rapid scaling, and it's not always easy to, you know, to live up to that commitment. And, you know, the structures that you need to involve your members or your customers in what you're doing, you know, when you're a business of 10,000 are very different to when you're a business of 1.7 million. So it's been a learning how we've, you know, how we create the structures at the scale we are now to carry on involving our members in what we do. And there are some, you know, really obvious places where we do that, like the Bulb community, which is our online forum where, you know, members can, you know, really tell us what they think of us, or where we look for members to give us feedback on products we're developing. For example, we're doing a trial at the minute with, you know, EV chargers, that sort of thing. So
do you have do you have a swear jar in the office if someone calls them a customer?
we do have some Slack tools which help with a few of these things where someone says, you know, because also, for example, we say referral program, not referral scheme, because scheme sounds a bit sort of, we're scheming potentially a little bit, you know, it's more negative than program. So we have a little bot that every time someone says scheme, it goes, did you mean program? So yeah, we do use that sort of thing. But interestingly, you know, in some places we've chosen not to say members. So actually in our first, you know, big TV ad, we said customers, because, you know, we thought that was the language that would be more easily understood by a mass market audience, lots of whom didn't know us. So we think really thoughtfully about that word a lot of the time.
But I think you raise an interesting point, and it may seem really simple, just that vocabulary change. But how much do you think it has had an impact on the culture of the organization by insisting on member rather than customer?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So, you know, we've tried to foster an environment at Bulb where people do think and treat our members first, you know, they put them first, and calling them members definitely helps with that. You know, I'm sure you could achieve that sort of approach without using the word members, but, you know, it adds, you know, I'm a wordsy person. You two are, I'm sure, as well. And language matters, and definitely choosing to call the members helps us to remember that we should take care with them, and that we're here to build something for them and with them. And it definitely helps us to sort of think about that every day at Bulb.
Let's talk a little bit about your marketing efforts, shall we? So we've mentioned TV, and I think, unfortunately, we still live in a world where going onto TV still feels quite big, scary, and definitely expensive. And I know the likes of Sky and ITV are trying to make some improvements there. But actually, there is a world where younger, smaller brands have opportunities to go onto TV, which you did with Bulb a few years ago, and you managed the whole thing in-house. So tell us how you did that and kind of what you learned from that original foray onto TV.
Yeah, so in the early days of Bulb, you know, we definitely weren't doing any TV advertising. We were a sort of classic digital first startup, and we were more comfortable with channels that we could sort of robustly measure. So, you know, digital marketing, we also, price comparison websites have been a big bit of Bulb's growth. They're, you know, important in energy. And our referral program, of course. So we really, for quite a long time, like 3 years, we really just focus on those channels. But at some point, you know, we realized that we would have to look to other things to help us to grow. We needed to be in places where, you know, we could meet new people. As was sort of typical of Bulb's approach, we looked for big levers that could help us grow. And TV was one of those. You know, around that time as well, the team grew and Russell Davis joined at Bulb, and, you know, he had lots more experience on telly. So, you know, we started thinking about what to do there. And But at the beginning, we sort of did a TV test ourselves. So we did it with Sky AdSmart. And what we did was we sort of went out on TV in a particular region and we looked at what had happened in that region in terms of signups versus the rest of the country. And what we were looking for was an incremental change in signups there to basically give us that confidence that you know, we could go and spend serious money on TV without, you know, without feeling like it was just, we had no idea what it would do for us. But we managed that process in-house from, you know, booking the TV through to making the creative. So our very first TV ad, we actually made totally ourselves. You know, later on when we got to doing a bigger campaign, we got some much needed help. But yes, we did that first campaign totally ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, not to sound too lofty, but kind of we're really starting to see a shift of digital first businesses making that leap into TV, whereas historically it was kind of TV first and kind of then started to amplify around digital. So
I think there's a lot that the channels, you know, could do to help with that as well, because, you know, in our case, that, you know, there was a reason we did it through Sky AdSmart, because we were, you know, nervous about understanding impact, and it gave us a way to, you know, relatively robustly understand that. But yeah, really only relatively robustly. You know, you have to take all of that with a big pinch of salt. And that's the challenge, I think, for lots of brands that are used to, and their sort of early stories are based on growing through things they really understand and have got good at iterating and tweaking and improving. And TV's much broader brush, and it's definitely sort of intimidating, at the beginning. So yeah, setting up those environments where, you know, you can have a go and test and learn, I think will really help lots of other smaller brands that get going with that.
So let's talk a bit about kind of client and agency relationships as well. It's something that is regularly mentioned on the podcast and certainly within the echo chamber that we live within. So you've spoken previously about doing as much as you can in-house. Kind of how and when is it right for brands, and certainly for you at Bulb, when is it right to seek agency support?
So at Bulb, we do a lot of stuff in-house, and that's been true, you know, since the early days. And I think it's good and right and proper that the people who sort of live and breathe the business every day do lots of its storytelling. I think that's good. But you run into a very practical problem, I think, when you have an in-house team and you're creating those things in-house, which is that, you know, you can't always have all the specialists you might want and need in your team. Like, it's just not practical to employ them, or, you know, it's not really affordable for a business. So you can't have, for example, the best person in the business at writing TV scripts, or the best person in the business at writing taglines, or doing this particular form of animation, or whatever it is, you know, in the team full time. So sometimes you need to get access to talent like that. And that's where I think an agency comes in. And so, you know, in summary, I think it's all about getting the best possible work. And I think doing lots of it in-house is a way of doing that, because those people really know and understand and are under the skin of your business. But it's also about knowing, you know, where help can really, really make you really, yeah, outside help can sort of supercharge that and help you in, you know, areas where you don't necessarily have the sort of capability to do it in-house.
With that perspective in mind, kind of from an agency's perspective, how do you think they need to evolve to kind of meet the changing needs of clients, certainly as we're talking about here, the growth of in-house?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, in our own case, it might be good to share kind of how we started working with an agency. So we work with Anomaly, they're our long-term creative partner. And when we sort of first started thinking about that, we actually worked with two agencies for a month. And we sort of set a task, and then we just got on with working together for a month, as we would do, you know, normally, if we sort of went on to set up a more formal partnership. And that was really interesting because, you know, it helped us to understand how our team would work with the agency team, as well as the sort of nature of work that they would produce on our behalf. And I think that's a clue to what a lot of businesses like Bulb are really looking for with an agency partner, which is someone who, you know, really wants to work collaboratively with the team in-house who are living and breathing the business every day, and, you know, do really great things together. And for us, that was, you know, that was a big priority. But it was important to us as well that we, you know, we work with someone who could help to make us better. So those are the things we, you know, we cared about. And the way we thought was a good way to sort of understand that was to work with these two agencies alongside and see what that process was like, rather than a kind of traditional pitch process, let's say. I think the other thing as well is flexibility. So, you know, a business at Bold stage is, you know, by nature, we move quicker and we, you know, pivot more than an established business that, you know, has, you know, a corporate setup and marketing doing this and a budget and everything's sort of quite formulaic. And, you know, at Bold, it's not like that. Things change very quickly. The market has changed very quickly over the last few years. So, you know, that creates sort of tensions in how you work with agencies, because what you want to do or what you think is important or how, you know, how you want to approach things, you know, can change quite quickly. So building sort of flexibility into arrangements like that is really helpful for businesses at the sort of stage Bold's been at over the last few years.
Okay, let's look to the future now. And you gave us a little bit of a vision of the energy future, which actually honestly excites me. I have to say, I have solar panels. I'm thinking of buying a battery as well. But tell me how you think Bold is going to develop over the next 5 years, and what bigger role will Bold be playing in its members' lives?
And that's great to hear. You've got solar panels. Well done. And a battery. Considering a battery, I mean, you're what we call a sort of energy hobbyist. You're on the fringe. Oh, okay. Yeah, you're on.
And I might buy an electric car next as well.
You've just moved into Bold segmentation.
I mean, that, you know, you're forward thinking, Mark. The next 5 years. So yeah, what's it about? So I mean, firstly, you know, we want to carry on growing. We still want to, there's lots of people who are still out there who we would love to switch to cheaper, greener energy. So it's about that. And that's in the UK, but also abroad. So we're now in Texas, France and Spain. So we'll be looking to help more people in those markets to discover us, as well as growing here. But yes, I think the next 5 years we'll also see Bold, or we hope, transition into more of that energy manager role. So helping someone to make sense of solar panels and electric vehicles and batteries. And that will mean a few things. So, you know, some of it will be product based. So it'll be about building great tools to help you sort of manage all of that in one place, like in the Bold app and the Bold account. It'll also be about thinking about, you know, pricing. So for example, you know, creating tariffs like for electric vehicle owners who, which incentivize them to charge overnight when it's cheaper, when energy is cheaper to use, to help them save on their bills. So all of that will be about helping people to make smarter, greener decisions about the energy they're using at home. So that's what I think the next 5 years will be about.
So Claire, before we let you go, our signature question on our podcast is kind of asking people about their favourite TV ad. So tell us your favourite TV ad of all time and why. And please remember, as we're an audio broadcast, do your best to describe it.
This was such a fun question to be asked. And there was one thing that came immediately to mind, which is a Coke ad from about, I think it's 2006, maybe 2007. I think they called it the Happiness Factory, and it features a person walking up to a vending machine and they put in their money, back in the days when you put a coin in there. And the story sort of unfolded from there, and you watch the coin go inside the machine, and it sort of reimagined what happened between someone putting their coin inside a vending machine and the Coke coming out at the other end. And they created this whimsical, magical world full of creatures who were all sort of helping to prepare to make the Coke the best it could possibly be before it arrived out the other end. So, you know, there was little sort of chubby flying things that got the bottle into the right place. There was a machine that filled it up. There was little things that kissed it to make it cold. They put some snowmen into a little fan and blew snow at it. That's one of my favourite bits. And then, you know, at the end, the Coke is on this sort of conveyor belt and all of the creatures inside this world are sort of celebrating it, and, you know, as if it's something beautiful and amazing they've made together. And then it sort of pops out the other end of the vending machine and the person sort of sips it, totally unaware of all of the glorious effort that's gone on inside to make it. I just thought, yeah, what a feeling it gives you, that ad. And also at the time, I mean, from an animation sort of point of view, you know, you just didn't see things like that in that much detail and as much as we do now. So it was really memorable at the time. And actually, even, yeah, at the time that it came out, I wrote to Coke and asked for some screenshots, particularly of the little kissy things I mentioned and the chubby flying things. I don't think I ever got them.
We have to put that right. We have to put that right. Calling. Who made the ad, Paul?
Yeah, that was Wyden and Kenny Amsterdam. So
if they're listening, Clem wants some merch from that campaign.
Yeah. I mean, yes, I would hazard a guess that they would see somebody writing to them for some screenshots is a pretty a bigger success than how many Coke bottles they sold.
I mean, what was I planning to do with those screenshots? Frame them and put them on the wall? I don't know, but
so yeah, that was Wyden Kennedy Amsterdam, this happiness factory, which was actually Emmy Award winning, which is quite impressive. 2006, as you mentioned, had several executions and actually ran for several years, which is always a good sign of the strength of an ad. So great choice and a lovely way to wrap up the podcast. So Clem, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a great chat. I knew it would be. Really enjoyed it. And I'm looking forward to more of us living the kind of energy future you have described. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Clem.
Bye.
Bye-bye.